Blenders, and welcome to episode number 107 of Real Blend, a podcast that worships whatever the hell Woody Harrelson is doing in Venom 2. Please tell me you guys saw those photos.
Yeah.
They are exquisite! Exquisite! I love everything about them!
But why?
Because, dude, he looks like everything that I want bad Woody Harrelson in awful Venom 2 to be.
But all that's going to mean is that the movie's going to be bad. And it's already the sequel to a bad movie. Like, why are you happy about this?
I'm a little bit okay with that.
I like the first Venom.
You did like
Yeah,
the first
well,
Venom.
You know.
I thought it was fun.
Yes, he did. All right, anyway, let's get through this week's episode on today's show. The Invisible Man will hit theaters this week, and we're going to have spoiler-free reviews. They better be spoiler-free, because I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to go see it in a few hours. Kevin also was able to sit down with writer-director Lee Whannell and has an amazing conversation with him about Invisible Man and his career in general. So without further ado, let me quickly introduce the guy. Oh, I always see, I get right to introduce the guys and I forget to introduce myself. My name is Sean O'Connell. I am the managing director here at Cinema Blend, the president of the Cletus Cassidy fan club. and I'm joined as always by Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hi, Jakey.
I'm doing well, my friend. I got just a quick apology to you. Because I sat down with Kevin McCarthy in New York last week, who,
yes,
in the most brief Cliff Notes version possible, told me about one scene from Human Centipede 3. Mm. And I got to be honest with you, I feel kind of bad.
You really should.
All the way, but I also have so much respect for both of you for watching the entire thing, because I would have hit that point and stopped. Right. And so for that, I apologize with a smirk.
Off air. Oh, actually, Kevin, just text me the scene. I need to know what the scene is.
So the one I told him about?
Yeah, I want you to text me.
I can keep it in one sentence. It was just the scene that with the removal of a private part matter of someone's body.
Oh, that wasn't even the worst. That wasn't even it for me. I would have guessed a different one.
Oh no, I gave him the G-rated scene. He has no idea what else we've been through.
Oh, Jake, that was nothing.
That's well, like, you know what? Pick park. Better Oscar choices next year.
Anyway, yes, the
Sean,
other person. Yes,
you and I, we are going to have our revenge.
It's a badge of honor, though, Kevin.
It will happen.
I'm proud of the two of us.
Me too.
Yes, that other voice, obviously, Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C. Hi, Kevin.
Sean, good to talk to you. Jake, good to talk to you. Gabe,
my
good
man.
To see you as always. And regarding the Venom, I thought the cool thing about Venom to me was Hardy's relationship with the character. I thought that part was cool, but I understand why people didn't love it.
I think Andy Serkis can explore more of that. So anyway, plugs for this week. A reminder for everybody that we have a community page over on Facebook. What are you looking all baffled about? What?
Because you're talking about him like he's Spielberg. What has he done that's proven himself as a director? Like, the acclaimed director Andy Serkis. Like, what? He did one Jungle Book movie that nobody saw. Like, what has he done that's given you hope
you're
that
so
he's going to save Venom?
You're so angry today.
Because you're all excited.
Don't even
over
like
a
movies.
Movie that's going to be crap.
Do you remember Bradley Cooper's directorial debut?
Wait, Star is Born?
Yeah.
Yeah, no. It was...
People can come out the gate and do good stuff.
It's pretty good.
Yes, but Andy Serkis already came out the gate. He's out the gate.
Yes, we're moving on. All right, plugs. The community page over on Facebook.
We're getting Sean all disheveled.
This is a place where you can go and have conversations about whether Andy Serkis is a good director or whether you like Woody Harrelson and what he's trying to do in Venom 2 as Carnage. Head over to Facebook and search for these words, Real Blend Podcast Community. They do an amazing job every single day of posting really fun content, polls that people can participate in, questions that I actually want to start bringing over to the show. Some really interesting things of like, which directors had the best three movie run? I saw somebody post recently and started to think about it. Ooh. And wanted to maybe bring that conversation over to the show. So that was a really good one. Also, in addition, if you guys like to watch podcasts on YouTube, we are running streams, our full episodes on Cinema Blend's YouTube page. Not that it's like the live element, Gabe, I want to bring the live element back. Like not the live element, but like the visual. Oh, Jake and Gabe are both No, they're shouting that down in real time.
I live enough of my life live on the air as it is. I enjoy knowing that I can do something and go
Jake,
back. And
you're so handsome, though. Like, if I would Truman Show my life if I looked like Jake Hamilton, for God's sakes. I would welcome everyone to come watch me do everything that I was doing.
Okay, fine.
And, of course, we're available on all your favorite podcast apps as well, too. I want to throw out the fact that I totally botched the weekly poll and didn't put it up last week. We came up with a topic. We even came up with options, and then I just didn't post it. So that's totally my fault. And then Gabe reminded me today, and I didn't even remember what the poll was. So instead, I'm going to take this time to plug the fact that over on Cinema Blend's YouTube page, you can watch me react to season one of Westworld. And Jake, I know you're watching them. Jake texts me when he's catching
watch
up
him at
on
the gym.
Reactions. Kevin, are you finally going to dive into Westworld?
I want to watch Westworld, but I have to watch Saul season 5 first. I have to watch Watchmen, and I have to watch Hunters. So I have a lot of stuff I got to watch.
Oh, my gosh.
When you're like me, and you're not married, and you don't have kids, you get to fill that giant void in your heart with television.
Yeah, I will give Sean a pass on his weekly poll mess up because when that Ben Affleck Snyder Cut news hit last week, I would imagine your mind was just in a billion places. So I'm going to go ahead and just, for Gabe and Jake and myself, I'm going to give you a pass on that poll.
Props to Cinema Blend for that scoop.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Props to Mike Reyes.
Mike Reyes, baby.
Yeah, that was really good. And I'll even tell you guys something a little subtle that we did. And I told this to Jake, Kevin, but you might appreciate this as well, too. This is a good chance for you to get it. See, a lot of times we go into these opportunities looking for scoops specifically. And Kevin, you and I had this conversation too about ways to phrase certain questions. And Kevin does a really great job of looking ahead to what the answer is probably going to be. So the way that we got Ben Affleck to talk about that was not to ask him about the Snyder Cut, but to just thank him for posting the hashtag on November 17th. Like, hey, man, thanks so much for posting that. It meant a lot to the movement. In hopes that he would take the baton and run with it. But then what I came up with, this is very strategic, and I'm giving this away on a podcast, so anyone else can use it for future things, I guess, is Mike was running audio on his phone and did it during the icebreaker when he was sitting down in the chair. So it didn't have to get picked up on the card, you know, it could just be part of the conversation. Haven't even looked to see if it got there yet, but I don't know.
You could have video of this and you don't even...
Yeah, I could actually have video of this and not even know, but...
You probably do.
Sly. I was very proud of the way that that all turned out. Well junket done. Tricks. Little junket tricks. So, anyway. This week, opening in theaters is The Invisible Man. It's funny. A while ago, it was supposed to be a continuation of the Dark Universe, and for a while had Johnny Depp cast in it. But then I think they just completely started from scratch. Like, tore it down to the studs, that's the phrase I was looking for, and built it up all over again with a brand new director, Lee Whannell, who had previously directed Upgrade and was a co-creator of the Saw franchise with James Wan. He's come a long way, branched out to become a director, and is now coming to theaters with The Invisible Man. Kevin, you want to set up the interview? How did you get him, and how did it go?
Well, I mean, for me... The Invisible Man was a movie that I was hesitant about because I was like, the story is one we've seen before. The idea of the Invisible Man, the Hollow Man with Kevin Bacon, you know, H.G. Wells. I mean, this is a very classic.
Hollow Man's a good movie, by the way.
I don't remember disliking Hollow Man, to be honest. But but going into this film, I didn't know what to take away from it. And as I sat down in the theater and the movie opens, with some of the coolest title card sequences I've seen, and for a budget of $7 million, I just don't really understand how the film was made. And even though in this interview you're about to hear, Lee Whannell breaks down a lot of the filmmaking, I still don't really understand. I think what makes me scared about this film the most is the technology used within the world of the movie to explain The Invisible Man is not too far off from what we might be able to experience some point in our lifetime. And that's what makes it so scary, is because if it can be possible and it can be real, you imagine what you would be like in that situation. That's what makes it so freakish. So I want to thank Lead for doing this interview. He's actually the one of the people who actually made it happen, because I had met him when I interviewed him for Upgrade. Upgrade is a masterpiece of an action film. If you haven't seen it, I rewatched it recently. It is so good for $3 million. So here is Lee Winnell, the director of The Invisible Man, and seriously one of the scariest films I've seen in a long time. Listen to this.
So. Do you think a full color version of that scene would have got him an NC-17?
100%. Yeah, that's why. Isn't that why Scorsese's blood in Taxi Driver is a little more on the orange side?
Yeah, there's a, yeah.
Isn't that crazy? Like,
yeah.
That's what I've always found so interesting about movies.
Yeah.
But,
all right. No, it's good. This is why it's good to, you're lucky last today. So let's get in there and
pop this on. It's funny, like, just before you sat down, Matt Reeves just put out the freaking Batman test, camera test with Pattinson. It looks
no, cool. You got to let me look at it.
Oh, you got to look at it then. Okay. We should react to it.
Yeah, exactly. To put it on, right. But you can start and say, Lee's just checking out.
All right. So we are here in L.A. We're talking about The Invisible Man. Before we start this interview, though, since Matt Reeves did release the Batman test footage, Lee's going to check it out right now.
Okay, I've Googled Batman test footage.
Go to
the Batman costume reveal.
That's it. Dude,
it's got to be it.
It's awesome, man.
Shout out to Slash Film.
Yeah.
Come on.
The footage is unreal.
You know what's going to happen? This is going to make terrible radio because my phone is going to be... Wait, there's the video.
Is there a Vimeo?
There's a video. Here's a video. Guys, this is makes for riveting podcasts. Listening to us watch something.
You got to go full screen, man.
You're right. What am I doing?
I don't know if this is Giacchino's music.
What? Go away. Hang on. We're seeing something. Now, it's a Batman costume. It's coming slowly into focus.
I guess they're going to use that as a batarang.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Off
so
of his chest.
Interesting. It's kind of an interesting idea. It almost looks like armor.
I'm trying to figure out if this is Giacchino's score or is this like temp stuff? I don't know what he's doing.
I don't know. It's a ballsy move to kind of put music on it because the thing is, people will get married to it.
That's what I'm wondering. Like, and that. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Okay. Cool. It's funny. Like,
I'm all in, man.
I remember. My daughter was watching that film. I think it's the feature film, Teen Titans. It's the Teen Titans feature film. And there's this great joke in it where they pull up to a movie premiere and the name of the movie is Batman Again. And like, I thought it was a great inside baseball joke. But I have to admit, no matter how many Batman movies they make, I'm always interested.
Dude.
And that doesn't happen for every hero.
No.
Like, you get fatigue. But with Batman... For some reason, the fatigue doesn't set in with Batman.
Did you like Affleck's Batman? I love Affleck's Batman.
I did. I thought that there were some elements of it when they first introduced him that I thought were really cool. Like when he was breaking up that kind of child slavery ring, that whole scene.
Yes.
In the house.
The warehouse.
Yeah, the warehouse.
Oh,
like it was just...
God. Snyder, man.
But the issue that I had is that he wasn't the complete star. Like, I'm like, okay, just give me a Batman movie.
We never had a Batman movie with Affleck.
Yeah, I know. It was always like he's a supporting character with someone else, yeah.
I'll ask this and then we'll transition in, but only because we just watched it. But as a filmmaker, you've been working in this business for a long time. What are your thoughts on this whole release the Snyder Cut movement? Like, the idea of a filmmaker possibly having another cut of his film. Like, I mean, as a director, does that seem... completely insane to you, or like,
I mean, it to me, I never want to have another cut sitting somewhere that competes with the original cut.
But
I mean,
rolled out. Remember, they brought Whedon in to finish the
right,
movie.
Right. But I guess what I'm saying is, whatever circumstances created that cut, whatever horrible circumstances, are totally understandable. For me personally, I would always view it as a terrible thing that there was an unseen cut of the film.
Yeah.
And I try to, you know, over the years you'll see this thing where it's like James Cameron re-releases the director's cut of Aliens.
Yeah.
And then he'll introduce it. When you watch the movie, he comes on the screen and he says, "This is the way I always intended people to watch Aliens." And my first thought is, that's nuts. Like, don't have one definitive version of the movie.
Yeah.
Don't. I hate this idea that we missed out on the version he wanted us to see.
But Blade Runner is an interesting story because Ridley clearly didn't want to
right.
have the voiceover in there, right?
And that's the situation.
Yeah.
That's the situation I'm saying would be a nightmare. Would be someone forcibly changing a film that I had made to such a degree that I felt the version out there was not the true version. That is a living nightmare that I don't want to live. Maybe I'll go through it one day.
Have you ever been pressured to change something in one of your films against what you wanted to do? Like I would imagine when the Saw stuff was happening and like that stuff was brutal. And I would imagine like the MPA had...
it was very minor notes. You have to remember Saw was an independent film. So there was no sense that... creative control was being taken away from James Wan and I. There was no sense that we were being micromanaged. I mean, we made that film for like $18, some glue and some spit. Like it was, if you can't have creative control on a film that cheap, then you don't have much.
Yeah.
You know, the trade-off you make is that when you make a blockbuster, you have all this money, you have all these toys, but you have a lot of opinions.
Did those opinions start coming in on 2, 3, like as they got more popular?
Not really, because we were seen as the authority, and it's almost this thing of like, get out of their way. Don't annoy the golden goose, you know, keep them happy, feed them and keep them pumping this thing out. And so I wrote 2 of the sequels before I stepped away. And
so you're responsible for the needle scene, aren't you?
Yeah, the needle pit was a low point.
Probably one of the most horrifying.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
It's okay. That will always be with me, though.
Yeah.
That will always
be. You gotta understand, you know, when you're writing a Saw film, that counts as a great day's work. You're like, yes, I did it. Yeah. I came up with something that'll, you know, make the audience physically ill.
Yeah.
But one of the reasons I had to step away from the Saw films, I felt, is that I couldn't think up any more ways to creatively kill somebody or dismember them. I was like, you know, I'm burned out on this. And, you know, they kept going and making those movies, but I just kind of had to step away.
What did you think of that trailer with Chris Rock and Sam Jackson? Did you guys have any insight into that? Is that?
We weren't a part of it. Like James Wan, who directed the original Saw film, obviously, and myself, we've really stepped away from the Saw films. It's a strange feeling of divorce because... this is something we created.
Yeah.
We brought it over from Australia to the US and, you know, inadvertently kickstarted this franchise, and now we don't have anything to do with it. So it's like...
was it weird watching the trailer? Did you know anything about it? Did you?
I did. I knew about it. I hadn't read the screenplay, but I was intrigued by the Chris Rock angle because it's such a weird angle to take. I mean, this is not someone who's known for this type of film, and... it's intriguing to me. It's funny because when I directed the 3rd Insidious films, that was my directorial debut, and they put me in one of those lists, you know, Variety magazines, 10 directors to watch. And I go to this party in Palm Springs, you know, these parties that they throw, and it was Variety magazine throwing a party for their directors to watch. And as I'm walking in, my agent, much to my horror, says to me, hey, I should introduce you to Chris Rock. And before I know what's happening, he like pushes me towards Chris Rock.
Wow.
And I said something lame like, I'm a big fan. And he said, thanks, and then walked away. And as he was walking away, his agent said to him, you know, this guy wrote Saw. And he just did a complete stop, 180, came back and was so interested and was like, you wrote Saw?
Do you think he was already...
yeah.
Thinking about it?
He said to me...
when was this?
This was
Insidious 3 was, what, 3, 4 years ago?
So it's 2014.
Wow.
It came out in 2015, so it would have been early 2015. And he said to me, I'm a big fan of Saw and I've always wanted to write a Saw film. And I thought he was just doing one of those things you do at parties when you say, hey, big fan of your podcast, I'd love to be a guest. And then you never follow up on
it. Yeah, no.
You know what I mean? And it's like, I thought he was just bullshitting me. Turns out Chris Rock wasn't joking.
Wow.
So the first thing I thought of when I heard that Chris was doing this film was I thought of that moment at that party. And I thought how, if I had known how serious he was, I probably would have said to him, well, we should spend some time together hanging out and I'll help you write that film because I want to hang out with Chris Rock.
Would you have been involved if he had said, can you come? I mean, obviously you're making Invisible Man, which we'll get into, which is the reason why you're here. But is that something you would have been like, or were you so detached from Saw by that point?
I feel like it's best to move on. Like, I feel like I'm entering this kind of new phase of my creative life where I'm writing these films and directing them, and I'm kind of building something. You know, when I look at Upgrade and The Invisible Man, they feel like companion pieces in certain ways. Yep. And you know, that's what you do, I guess, as a director. You try to build a body of work. you know, if you take someone like Chris Nolan and you look at his last 20 years of films, there's a symmetry there, and there's a through line, and there's themes that he comes back to, and there's a look that it'll all make sense, you know, at the end of his career, whenever that is, there'll be this body of work that all links together somehow.
That's important to you.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, that's cool.
The filmmakers that I admire, they have that. You know, I've seen lately with the release of The Irishman, I've seen a lot of retrospective pieces about Scorsese's career.
Yeah.
I think people are aware that he's getting older. He's maybe coming towards the end of his career. You know, hopefully he does get to make many more films, but I'm seeing these pieces and holding a mirror up to this decades-long career. And it's fascinating because there are these through lines and these commonalities with all of them. It doesn't matter if he's making a film about, you know, Howard Hughes or
even Hugo, Tibetan still monk. Had his
yeah,
voice,
Hugo,
you know?
Exactly.
That, and that was not any. That's my favorite Scorsese movie, which is strange.
Is that true? Wow.
I didn't know the classics. You would probably go with like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Mean Streets, but
I would say Goodfellas for me is to me it's my favorite of his movies for many reasons, but. But I agree with you that Hugo...
It was a love letter to filmmaking.
Yeah, Hugo totally speaks to his obsessions. And I guess that's the dream, is to build a body of work that fits together, you know?
You know, you mentioned Upgrade leading into Invisible Man, and our co-host Sean was texting me this morning. He was like, ask Lee about what Upgrade gave you freedom-wise to build into Invisible Man. And you think about, I mean, there are shots in this film that I think are, those are Lee shots. Like right, yeah. Your voice is
there.
The
stunt team would actually call them Winnells. They would say like, oh, this, we got this Winnell coming up.
Yeah.
Where the camera was actually locked to the actors.
Did you, now, Upgrade, you had iPhone shots. Did you throw some iPhone?
Actually, we went a bit upmarket with this one. We got a motion control camera, which is essentially a robot. It's really funny when you direct with a motion control camera. It's kind of similar to dance choreography. It's all about timing. You know, if you have a human cameraman, they can improvise. They adjust. You know, if an actor makes a split second decision in the moment to sit down, then a living camera operator can move down and accommodate that. Well, a robot has no such time. A robot does only what it's programmed to do. So you have this timing. You can't even use the sound when you're shooting motion control because all you can hear is this voice booming across the set.
You have to ADR that stuff?
Yeah, you have to redo everything because on the set, what you hear is this voice saying, and one, and two, and three, and four.
Wow.
So that's how the actors learn where they need to be. They know that on five, they need to be over at that table. And so, because the camera is going there, and it moves really quickly and precisely, like it'll take your head off if you.
What does it look like for my audience? Like is it on a track? Is it like is it physically like?
It almost looks like. Do you remember the opening scene of Alien?
Yeah.
Where her little escape pod ship gets sucked into that big thing, yeah. And this laser cuts open the door, and this thing comes through the door and starts scanning for life. It looks like that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It moves very quickly. Yeah. Like, if everyone has to be very conscious of it because it will take your head off. It's a very expensive piece of equipment, and it makes these precise moves. Apparently, I heard David Fincher loves shooting with it because it's so precise, and he wants that clean, clinical move. And so shooting those scenes, these fight scenes, you know, it felt like a more expensive version of what we were doing with Upgrade. Upgrade felt like the punk version of like, yeah, let's strap an iPhone to this actor and see what happens.
Yeah.
Whereas this movie was like a long rehearsal period, getting used to the idea of this motion control camera, and also a lot of takes because, you know, I stupidly decided I want to do it all in one shot. So there were certain scenes in the movie where the motion control camera would be moving for a long time, and all you need is for Elizabeth to miss her mark once, and we have to go back to the start.
How long is that shot in the kitchen?
You know what? I've never timed it. I think it's about... There's actually a cut in there.
Yeah,
it doesn't feel like it. There is a cut.
You can't see it, though.
Yeah, it's hard to spot, but I'd say it's about, like, maybe... A little under 2 minutes,
it's an
I think,
insane
from start
sequence.
I'm glad you like it. It's funny because you're talking to me so close to the end of the movie.
Yeah.
Usually when I finish a movie, there's this decompression period of a few months. And then after a few months, suddenly you'll start hearing about a press plan and a publicity and it starts ramping up. And I mean, I've had movies released a year after I finished them.
Wow.
So that's a whole year of moving on, doing other things before you're dealing with it. This movie has been a strange experience because I'm doing interviews with people like yourself right after I finished it. It's almost like I was just in a car crash. I've gotten out of the car and you've shoved a microphone in my face and said, tell me what it's like to be in a car crash. You know, I'm like, give me a couple of months to, you know, yeah. to sort
it's
of...
It's good that you haven't had time to process it.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, you know what I mean? It's interesting. It's probably, tell me if I'm... Is it really $7 million to make this movie? Is that true?
Yeah, American, yeah. We went to Australia. So what happens is you grow the money there. The exchange rate will add some money and then there's soft money that comes in from the government. There's tax incentives that Australia offers. So basically you can turn 7 million American into 14 million Australian. So shooting in Australia, all of a sudden you have a better budget. That's the reason why producers want to shoot in these other countries.
Yeah.
It's because of that extra money. So Australia for me on a budgetary level makes a lot of sense.
People are going to see this and not believe it only cost $7 million. Really? It's truly amazing. And I do eventually in this interview, I want to kind of break down a scene with you because I'm really into like the way filmmaking is and we won't go. Well, this is just one kitchen scene, but I want to get to that shortly. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was talking to my co-host today about this and we know that there was the Dark Universe that Universal was building for a while. And then we had the Mummy film come out. Mm-hmm. Critically, it wasn't well received. I don't think it did well enough that they wanted to continue with it.
Right.
Was there ever a version of this story where Depp was your lead and was it different at all? Were you even attached at that point?
No, it was weird. This film came about in a really random way. It wasn't like I was plugged into some world building. I just finished Upgrade. They called me in for a meeting with some of these Universal execs and the Blumhouse execs. I thought for sure that we were going to talk about Upgrade because I had just finished that. And, you know, Blumhouse were the studio that made Upgrade. Universal was involved. So it made sense to me that it was going to be this big conversation. And I was sort of in this mindset that I'm in now with you. I was very raw about the movie. I just finished it. I was nervous about what the world would think of this movie. So I go to this meeting and they didn't really talk about Upgrade. I mean, they said they liked it and then they moved on. And so I was sitting on a couch just like this one. And I'm thinking, you know, what am I here for? What is this meeting about? And they started talking about The Invisible Man. And I just thought it was kind of a non sequitur. Like, you know, what would you do with this character?
Had you ever expressed interest in this
property? No, never. I mean, I'm aware of the character, never thought about that character in any way. Wasn't pursuing it. So didn't have a burning desire. It was just brought up to me. And I think there's something to be said for a lack of fear. I always think of that movie Office Space. That classic thing where when he stops giving a shit, everything goes right. You know, they call him in for the job performance review and they're like, what do you do here? And he's like, nothing. And instead of saying you're fired, they're like, that's exactly the attitude we need. You know, it's that counterintuitive.
Yeah, exactly.
I kind of felt like there's a freedom in that. So because I didn't care or wasn't needy of this Invisible Man character, I was blurting out these ideas. You know, they said, well, what would you do with it? And I offhandedly said, you know, well, I would probably tell the story from the point of view of the victim, maybe a woman who's escaping a relationship and suddenly she finds out that this abusive ex of hers is much closer than she thought.
That came out of just nowhere.
Just right there on that couch. Wow. And you know, I don't want to paint it in terms of this bolt of out of the blue, a stroke of genius. It was more like that's what seemed obvious to me and there was none of that neediness. I wasn't going in there, palms sweating, begging for a job. Obviously, many times as a writer, you go into a room trying to convince somebody, I'm the guy to write this movie. This was the opposite. This was them suggesting something to me and me throwing something out there. When I walked out of the room, I still didn't have any inclination or inkling that I would end up doing this movie. But a couple of days later, I started getting these phone calls, you know, from the guys at Blumhouse and Universal saying, we really liked that direction that you came up with. And I was thinking, God, that was just, you know, that was just an improvisation. That's it, you know, and then...
Where's Dark Universe at this point?
It hasn't been mentioned. So The Mummy had come out. This was in...
Okay.
This was in... this must have been... When did Upgrade come out? This must have been like Mid-2018.
So there's no mention in the meeting about, like, this being a connected universe.
No.
Interesting.
Nothing.
Interesting.
And it was only ever treated as a standalone film. And at a certain point, I was made aware of this dark universe. People would tell me about it. When I would tell them I was doing The Invisible Man, they would ask me about this universe. And I started to sneak around a little bit, like I'd gotten into a party I wasn't invited to and didn't want to draw attention to myself in case someone said, hey, what are you doing here? Mm. So I was just like, don't mention the war, don't mention the war. And at no stage did someone call me and say, hey, by the way, we'd love it if we could have a cameo from Dr. Jekyll in the movie. Mm. Or we'd love you to come in and look at some of our plans. It was only ever treated by Universal as a standalone film, and they were so supportive of it. And had a lot of great ideas. Like, you know, these people are really smart people. So a lot of the notes I was getting from them were just helping the film.
So, but Depp was never involved in your version.
No.
Wow. That's so interesting to me.
Yeah. I guess it was a direction that they put a lot of money and resources into at one time.
Yeah.
Didn't work out the way they wanted. The thing is, in the movie business, There's what's being said and there's what's really going
on. Right.
So yeah. Now with hindsight, I realize that, of course, this was a big meeting that was had before I was ever in the room between Jason Blum and Universal, where they said, you know, how about Lee Whannell for one of these characters? He'd be great for The Invisible Man. And so it was an ambush that you walk into, but I'm such a doe-eyed fawn in the crosshairs of a rifle that I just sit there and fall right into their trap. You know, they Jedi mind tricked me into thinking that it was my idea. It was literally like Obi-Wan waving his hand and saying, this is the movie you want to make. I walked out of there being like, well, damn right I want to make that film. But I loved the experience, so I'm glad they tricked me into making it, because I had a really rewarding film experience, yeah. You know?
What's terrifying about this film is how close to reality it appears to be. And it's like one of those weird things where as you watch it, you go, okay, that is extreme, but for some reason I could believe that that could really happen. Like the idea of holograms and light and reflection. The science behind the concept of what the suit is truly insane to me. I was reading the production notes about it, about how the backwards cameras are actually the front-facing hologram. Can you give our audience like a basic rundown of the science of kind of... And I understand that this is like a futuristic thing, that this would be trillions of dollars to pull off in reality. But what is the science behind how that suit would work?
I mean, for me, it's all about... it's projection. It's cameras mapping any room that you walk into and taking thousands and thousands of photographs per minute and then projecting each image so that wherever you move, you're changing the perspective. I talked to some scientists and and they said it was plausible and possible. You know, if you had the right tech and you could figure it out, it's amazing what cameras can do. And to be honest, I don't think that we're that far away.
No.
I don't think there's that much of a bridge between an app on your phone that can change the look of your face or age you or erase objects from a room and being able to do this. So that's what I really felt was freeing about this movie, was using tech to ground it. I wanted to make it very grounded, realistic. I wanted to get away from the idea of a serum or a potion,
yeah.
You know, these more gothic retro ideas.
But it makes it more terrifying when it's real.
That's
what I think makes the movie so freaking scary, is like that it could really happen.
Yeah, that's I needed that. I wanted that for this movie. Is I was like, how do I make a movie that feels realistic when it's titled The Invisible Man? You know, it's like sitting there and saying, okay, I've got a movie here called Attack of the Martians, but I need it to feel completely grounded and real. Like, how do you take those ideas... and it's all about the execution. Like, first of all, you have to just treat it at face value, like this is real. But second of all, you have to have all the ideas grounded in some basis of real science. You know, it's all about research as well. I did plenty of research on this stuff. And I think tech was my best friend because, you know, I grew up on movies that were filled with these sci-fi concepts that are now just part of our everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, we all thought it was crazy that he could talk to his wife over a video phone in Total Recall, you know, when I went to see that movie. Now, you know, my daughter thinks nothing of FaceTiming her grandmother.
Total Recall FaceTime. Oh,
remember
my
that?
God.
And you, by the way, if you go back and watch that movie, their version of it, it wouldn't pass muster today. Like, people would be like, what is this clunky device? Like, what used to be... I feel like you could start a whole nother podcast called, you know, 80s sci-fi concepts that are now just common. Yeah. And just totally dissect, like, oh, remember when that was trippy? Like, being able to talk to your phone. You know, it's just, it's ridiculous. And that ends up becoming your friend when you're writing a film inflected with science fiction. It's because you can connect the audience's perception to your movie very quickly because they're so used to this tech in their everyday lives.
So I want to walk through the kitchen scene. And mm-hmm. I know we did this briefly in the TV interview yesterday, mm-hmm. but I don't want to give too much away. Like, this podcast is a director's podcast. So our listeners love to know the filmmaking because in my opinion, I think knowing things can actually enhance the experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
If a filmmaker does it well, which you do.
Yeah.
But that kitchen scene is the first kind of time where she really has a genuine interaction and fight with Invisible Man.
Yeah.
It's truly amazing. It's one shot, as you mentioned. There's a stitch in there, but she gets lifted off the ground, pushed into a wall, thrown over a table.
Mm-hmm.
On set, can you walk me through it, since it is in the trailer, what that took to pull off? Like, how are you lifting her off the ground? How are you throwing her? I mean, we're not seeing anything. And then the budget, that doesn't make any sense how the hell you did it. So I'm just curious, like, can you walk us through it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of meetings. You know, films are mostly planning. It's like, it's a long conversation for a short execution. Mm. You know, you have weeks of chats and then you have to shoot it all in a day. So it's really...
You didn't do that scene in a day.
Yeah.
No, you did not.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All in a day. And and so we had many talks about it and we realized, okay, we were going to use motion control.
All right, and so explain what that is for the
audience. It's a camera that is a robot, essentially. It's on an arm, it's on this gimbal, and the camera is run by a computer, and it's a very precise move. They use it in car commercials a lot because they want those very precise kind of moves, and it can do things that a human being can't. It can move a lot quicker than a human being ever could, and it can also ramp up to a weird angle, like over the top of a car or something. So we knew we wanted to use that, and we wanted to combine a stunt performer in a green suit with wires. And so we ended up stitching three different shots together that have invisible cut points. It's actually a stunt woman that gets thrown over the table, but we do this blend. So she crawls in and you don't see it, but we wanted it to feel all seamless. So you sort of have to take three different shots and blend them together. Say with the stunt person, right? You have Elizabeth crawl right up to the point where she's about to get thrown, and then you call cut. And you take the stunt person, you put her in the exact same position using ghosting with the monitors. You get her in that position so that she matches exactly, and then you throw her across the table. Jeez. And when she lands, everybody freezes and takes a million photos, and then you do the same thing with Elizabeth again. And then when you stitch it all together using visual effects at the end, it feels like one seamless shot, but it's actually three different shots.
But as she lifts up in the air for the first time, is that a person lifting her? Is it a wire? Like it's just unreal.
Yeah, it's wires. There's wires, and then there's like... we used a combination of like a stunt performer in a green bodysuit pulling her along the floor by the ankle and also wrestling with her, and we found out really quickly that it's really tough to erase someone from a film frame.
Yeah, how do you get your clean plates?
Well, in one case, we didn't have good clean plates. So what we actually had to do was rebuild some of the set in VFX, you know, like replace it because we didn't have clean plates. Jeez. So it's a million different approaches. And then we would also do things using ropes. We had a props guy off camera pulling a rope to flip the table over. So it's kind of a mixture between really state-of-the-art CG and like...
In-camera effects.
In-camera practical effects that they would have used on the 1933 Invisible Man. They would have been using ropes and strings to move things. Well, we do that too. And...
How did they erase the Invisible Man in the 30s?
I actually read a big article about it, but it was something to do with exposure and how they used double exposures and were able to... feature certain objects but not others. So the glass would be seen to lift in the air, but you could erase using these sort of exposures of film and layers, that the layering allowed them to lose the guy but keep the glass, you know. It's fascinating if you read into it.
Yeah.
But we definitely used some of those old school approaches. I mean, and then sometimes it was really lo-fi. Like in one particular scene, an actor just beat themselves up. You know, Aldous Hodge should get some sort of award for beating himself up.
Yeah. I know, that scene is brutal.
Yeah, and like him and Ed Norton should be sitting back with an award on their shelf for fighting themselves. But Aldous, he's a very athletic guy. He's done a lot of stunts, and he's just able to perform in a way. Yeah, he can throw himself around in a way that feels very realistic. So all I care about is getting the job done. Mm. Like, as long as the audience feels that the entire effect is seamless, I don't care whether it's an actor throwing themselves around or an expensive, you know, computer effect. All I care about is what is the effect on the audience. So if people tell me the kitchen scene is amazing and hard hitting and kind of an explosive scene, then I'm happy.
Wow. I want to talk about Wallfish's score, because as the film opens, and for people who don't know the story behind this, as you mentioned earlier, you're dealing with a woman who has been dealing with domestic abuse. The husband is, you know, we learn all this through the beginning of the film as she tries to sneak out of the house and move on with her life. But you open the film up with this beautiful, like, these title cards as the waves hit the water, and then you have the title cards pop up, and then we go inside the house, and then that same wave sound. But you have Oliver's hand over Elizabeth's chest as she's sleeping. Mm-hmm. And while that seems like a normal thing you would do as a couple in bed together, it really is a power thing, right?
Yeah. I wanted her instantly to be escaping from this control, you know.
He controlled everything about her.
Yeah, like, exactly.
The mind, everything.
Yeah, he made her change her hair and how she looked and how she dressed. And Elizabeth Moss and I would talk a lot about that she had a very distinct look for when she was in his house. She was all made up to go to bed with her hair all blonde. And then later you see her, she's a bit more dirty blonde, a bit more natural. Yeah. She's wearing more down-to-earth clothes. So the hand is, you know, with a movie, you're always trying to communicate a lot of information in a short span of time. Yeah. Audiences today have watched so many movies that they're cataloging things at light speed. You know, they have a really fast, you know, fact retention for your movie. So I know I can put that arm over Elizabeth and say a lot about her situation.
It says everything. It says everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And just a hand.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that's insane.
Yeah, and it's great that you notice that. Sometimes when you make these decisions on a movie, you think about it, you have a big conversation about it with the actors, and then you wonder if anyone in the theater is going to take it home with them. So when you say that, it's definitely a gift to give to the filmmaker to say, I loved that moment, because it's basically the ribbon at the end of the marathon. Like, I did it. I did something on film months ago in Sydney, Australia, that's resonated with someone from Washington, D.C.
So. It's crazy. So as that film opens, I wanted to ask you about camera and space. As the film goes on, and if we get into anything spoilery, I can hold those things until after release. But as we're in that scene, there's a moment where Elizabeth Moss's character is changing. And you have a camera position, you look over at her, and then the camera then goes, pans left down a hallway. As a horror film, you start wondering, okay, who's coming down that hallway? Something crazy going to happen. But in my opinion, it ended up being a POV aspect to it.
I think at that stage for me, what I wanted to do was introduce the audience to the visual language of this movie. I wanted to make a movie where the camera was a character of its own.
That's what I wanted to tell you. Because I feel like sometimes if you tell a filmmaker that, they go, well, I didn't want you to notice it. And like, to me, the greatest balance a filmmaker can achieve, like someone like a Wes Anderson, like where his camera is clearly moving around and it's a character. To me, the best thing about a filmmaker doing that is that you can find that balance where you don't lose yourself in the story, but you can appreciate that the camera itself is a character. And I think that's what...
Usually movies are trying to hide that fact.
Like, right.
They want the audience to forget that there's a camera there at all.
Right.
And
it's risky to tell them there's a camera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you start knocking on that fourth wall, you risk the audience checking out of the movie. But I decided to take that risk because I was like, I want to do something unique. I've made a lot of horror films. I have to do something different here to keep myself interested. And I decided that with a movie called The Invisible Man, I could point the camera down an empty corridor and make it tense. You know, the audience would be suspicious of empty space.
Yeah.
Because of the villain, because of the title of the film.
And you use space really well. Like,
yeah.
I was like, this could have been shot on 70mm, like Hateful Eight style, because every single space of the room felt important.
Yeah, I wanted the audience to be doing half the work for me and searching the frame going, wait, did I just see something? Did I just miss something? Yeah. Oftentimes we would call action and I would say, wait, hold it, and run in and move something, like a curtain or something. Wow. I wanted a sense of paranoia that filled every frame, that never let you off the hook.
Yeah. I'm curious about horror beats. What I mean by that is like beats when you're going to hit the audience with something shocking. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as I was watching this film, like I actually felt at moments, I was like, is he going to hit me here? And then you don't. And then the scare or whatever, the violent moment will come later in the scene. Are you aware that the audience may think that that's coming at that point?
Yeah.
Do you actually take that into consideration?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've made enough horror films and watched enough horror films to know where the audience expects something to happen. And the fun is in the tease. The fun is in walking the audience up to the line, staring over the cliff, and then walking them back. And you can really make people squirm.
Yeah.
Because in a way, an adrenaline spike or a jump scare is letting the audience off the hook, because as soon as it's happened, there is a release that happens. That it's a tension release.
It's like a laugh and a comedy.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a laugh. Yeah, exactly. It's happened and you come down from it. I don't want to do that. I think filmmakers sometimes make the mistake of thinking that the juice of the film is in the scare moment. Actually, it's in the walk up to the line. It's the teasing out and the not paying off that makes people kind of clench into a fist, you know, and just be like, come on. And you know, I was really inspired by Hitchcock on this movie. I was watching a lot of Hitchcock movies when I was preparing to write the script and just kind of analyzing like exactly how he uses the camera to make the audience certain that something terrible is about to happen. And I just knew I could mess with people on this movie because I have a villain who's not visible.
Yeah.
I mean, he could be standing right next to you and we wouldn't know it. And, you know, there's a scene, I won't spoil anything in the movie, which I knew would be a big shock in the movie.
That scene, which we'll keep vague, is like one of the... I would imagine that you probably can't wait to go opening weekend and just sit in the back of the theater and then have that scene take place.
I know. I really am looking forward to it. There are certain really vocal audiences. Like, I'd love to go to Times Square, New York, and just watch one of those midnight audiences in the movie. But yeah, those moments are the fun ones when you just rip people's heads off.
Yeah.
You know, you've teased them enough and you're like, okay, fine, I'll give you a little gift here and let you off the hook for a while.
Yeah.
So yeah, man, I'm glad it resonated with you. I mean, when you're shooting it, you have this idea that maybe this will work, but you really don't know until you stick it in front of people. And we did a couple of test screenings and a lot of the scenes that I hoped would be shocking are definitely shocking.
Yeah. I'm getting, there's someone in the doorway. Like,
it's kind of like,
do we have a couple more minutes I don't want to keep him. It's the end of your day.
It's so, all good. It's all good.
Do you have a couple more minutes?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Walfish's score. The way you utilize score in this film, like camera, is like a leading character.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of moments where the score is not there at all. There's no sound.
Mm-hmm.
And in regards to like the music, and that actually becomes an immersive quality in itself because you're like in that scene. There's no music.
Yeah,
you're
just nice. Dealing with the That's breathing. Good.
But then you hit us with that brutal score of his, like that main
yeah.
Can you talk about, as a director, how you direct score? How do you, do you direct it like an actor? Do you direct like a character? And do you think about it like from an emotional arc standpoint about when you want to hit the audience?
Absolutely. You need to think about it as if it's part of the screenplay.
Yeah.
You need to think about what, because I don't believe in just score for score's sake. You know, if we have a scene of spaceships flying, you know, maybe we have this pounding music, but I think the score is better when it's counterintuitive. Like, for instance, if someone's walking down a dark corridor, I'd prefer not to score it.
Hmm.
I'd rather let silence be the thing. And then all of a sudden hit the audience with the score in a place they don't expect. So it actually becomes it becomes an addition to the movie rather than just... playing along with the movie, it kind of fights against it in a way.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have two concurrent themes in the film, one for Cecilia's character, which was very organic orchestral instruments, and then Adrian, which I wanted to be very abrasive, electronic.
Brutal.
Yeah, and just brutal. And so Ben Wolfish, he's done some amazing scores. You know, he did Blade Runner 2049. He did the It movies. He has a foot in both camps, because if you listen to the score for It, it's very orchestral, traditional.
Yeah.
If you listen to Blade Runner, it's this like, you know, futuristic, kind of forward-thinking, synth-orientated score. So I was like, just think of these two camps, and we would talk a lot about the emotions. I wanted it to be almost difficult to listen to. I wanted the film to be stressful, and one of the ways to do that is to make the score... It's not even music. It's like this like grinding sound that kind of wears you down.
It's like almost like a it's almost like sound in the film world. Mm-hmm. Like it's actually an interesting, because like even the waves almost kind of, the wave crashing almost kind of leads you into that being something that could exist in the sound of the world of the movie, which is actually interesting.
Yeah, that's I love sound design. You know, that's one thing you don't get asked about much as a filmmaker. It's great to talk about it.
Look at what Mangold did in Ford v Ferrari. Like that's all sound. The sound is what makes that.
Yeah,
those car scenes.
But if that's the case, why aren't there any long conversations about film sound? You know, I hear a lot of people idolizing cinematographers and directors, but sound is just such an unsung hero. It's 50% of the medium.
Yeah.
You know, it's an audio-visual medium, and people will complain in a theater a lot faster if the sound's not working than the visuals. Yeah. You know, like sound is really the thing
that works.
Yeah, exactly. It just gets taken for granted, and you put so much work into it. I love talking about it because, you know, aside from Ben's score, Will Files was the sound mixer on this film, and he's worked on tons of movies. You know, he worked on the Star Trek movies, Star Wars. So he was kind of almost out of our budget range. So we felt really blessed to have someone at that level. And he and I just had so much fun for weeks at Sony Studios throwing sounds all over the room. We used like the Dolby Atmos system to kind of, I would say, I want things to go off the screen. Like there's one scene. Did you have that moment where the bed sheet gets pulled and you did your eyes go off the screen to the corner of the theater?
My eyes were trying to find more frame in your film that was on the screen. Like when you're like looking down into that attic thing. Oh, of course.
So you're like leaning over.
Oh, yeah, if you saw me in that scene, I was like this. And I literally almost stood up in the theater. I mean, all right, as I wrap up, Oliver, obviously we can't say so much about what he's doing in the film, but because his character is the invisible man in regards to the emotion that she's dealing with, did he still play him invisible?
Sometimes he would. Sometimes we would get him in just to be a presence, and sometimes we wouldn't have anybody. It was really all over the place. Sometimes in the movie, when you're looking down a corridor, there really is someone there that we've had to erase. And other times it would just be emptiness. You know, we would have whole scenes where Elizabeth was having a conversation with nobody.
Wow.
So it was really fun, man. It's been a great experience, and like you've caught me right at that moment when I just finished it. So it's good to unpack it in real time.
Yeah.
Like be like, okay, this is what we were intending to do, and you know, seeing how it's landed.
All right, we're gonna wrap this up, but thank you so much, Lee, for
joining us. Thank you, mate. Always good to chat to you.
Everyone, please check out Upgrade if you haven't seen it. It is truly incredible, and the camera work in this film is the same. It's just unbelievable what you did here. I don't understand. I still think the budget, there's no way you made it for $7 million. I just don't understand it. Well,
it's all a lie. Cheers, brother. Good to see you again.
I appreciate it.
That's fun, man.
That was a good time.
Obviously, we want to thank everybody at Universal Pictures for giving us the time with Lee. I'm psyched to go see Invisible Man. Kevin's got me really fired up for it. I'm going after we record this episode. And it's, you know, after Bad Boys for Life, that I haven't had something to be excited about at the theaters. It's been a very quiet January, February. I like Birds of Prey, but that was one that I sort of went into tentatively, not quite sure how it was going to play out. It's not doing as well as the studio hoped it was going to do, so hopefully Invisible Man does really well. I know when Kevin came out of it, he said, you guys are not prepared for how well this movie is going to do.
It's unreal. And I'll tell you right now, and we can get into this later on in the show at some point, it's probably one of the few films I've actually sat down to think about sound design. And I rewatched Upgrade the other day, and you think about a movie that costs $3 million and looks the way that film looks, it's all about the sound design and how he builds the world. And that's what's so crazy about The Invisible Man.
So we're heading to a theater where we don't normally do press screenings because Universal requested a Dolby Atmos theater.
Oh, wow.
Yes, which is very rare.
Let me tell you something right now. to keep this it's so hard to explain, but you, the tension you will feel from the opening frame until the end, it's, I haven't felt that type of insecurity in it as an audience member where I just genuinely was scared to death. I did not know what was going to happen, because you have to understand the idea of somebody being in your house that you can't see, that is there to hurt you, and it's actually technically possible how that person is in your house. That's if awesome. You think about it. And that is so freaking scary to me, because it's, I don't know how else to explain it other than it is genuinely terrifying.
Okay.
That's all I will say.
All right, good. Yeah. We're going to get to it later in the episode, too. We're going to go into a little bit more details about it. But before we do that, staying on the... Yes.
When you see it, I want you, when you get out of it, I want you to text me and tell me how that was made for $7 million.
Okay.
I want you to honestly try and tell me how you think it was made for $7 million.
Well, Kevin, they saved on half the cast because one of them's invisible.
Yeah, that's funny.
Come on,
that's
now.
Funny.
They don't but have to show...
How do you explain a one-shot scene where Elizabeth Moss is being thrown around a kitchen with no one there?
Well, I don't know what I mean?
It's pretty wild.
Let me see it, and then I'll tell you all the secrets. All right, staying on the Universal bandwagon, Jurassic Park has revealed minutes before we started recording this episode that the new title for Jurassic World 3, not Jurassic Park 3, is Jurassic Park Dominion. Jakey, as our resident Jurassic fanatic, does the word Dominion float your boat?
It's for me less the word Dominion and more the fact that everything about the logo and the font is going back to the original. They're using that because remember that all the Jurassic World was very steel and blue. And the logo kind of like it was the T-Rex logo, but it was very steely. It looked very modern. Everything about this is all Jurassic Park, and it's throwing back to Jurassic Park. And of course, as we know, Dr. Sadler is coming back, Dr. Grant's coming back, and hopefully Ian Malcolm in a much bigger role than he was in Fallen Kingdom. And then I saw, was it Joseph Mazzello?
Yeah, Timmy.
Hinted that Timmy might be coming back. And the implication is if Timmy's coming back, that his sister's coming back as well.
Right.
So that excites me. You know, it's so funny. I always get so excited over these movies. And then end up not liking them. I mean, I haven't genuinely liked a Jurassic movie since The Lost World, since Spielberg was still behind the camera. But I still get so jacked whenever they come out. I hold on to that nostalgia. And I think it comes from my love of the first one so much. And I actually really do like The Lost World quite a bit. So yeah, I'm in, dude. I'm in. Call it whatever the hell you want to call it. They got my money.
We all have those franchises where no matter how many times they set up another one, you look at it like, nah, I'm not getting excited for that one. And then you do, and then
what's yours?
Disappointed. Well, for the longest time, it was the Die Hard franchise, but the Russian one.
But you weren't burned. You've been burned once. Okay, you got burned once. I've been burned for 20 years.
I'm thinking there's another one. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's another one. Kevin's is the Terminator franchise.
Oh, my God. I've been burned so many times on the Terminator franchise. Yes. It was funny, like the other day, like there was like some trending tweet thing going around that if you could make one sequel to any movie ever, what would it be? And I was like, Terminator 2, probably, because they've tried 5 times and every one of them has been genuinely pretty bad. I rewatched 3 the other day and that did not hold up. By the way, Chris Pratt just Instagrammed about the title and I thought it was actually an interesting definition. So Dominion, which, you know, we all know what it means, but the way he describes it was interesting. It's sovereignty or control, man's attempt to establish dominion over nature.
Oh.
Which I think, you know, now that makes a lot of sense considering the concept of Jurassic Park and Jurassic World. So it's funny, when I heard the term dominion in our text chat, I was like, that's a weird title. Because it doesn't really flow, right? Jurassic World, the Fallen Kingdom flows. Jurassic Park, or the Lost World, that flows. Jurassic World Dominion just seems a little abrupt. But man's attempt to establish dominion over nature? Okay.
Okay, yeah.
That's pretty deep.
My only thought is that, like, at the end of Fallen Kingdom, there were only, like, 18 dinosaurs that got out. Like, what? Like, yeah. If the plot of this one is that dinosaurs are taking over our modern world, they're gonna need more than whatever fit into that little house at the end.
So does that mean that this is basically Lost World again?
Lost World was just the T-Rex that was running around, what is it, San Francisco or San Diego?
But the T-Rex left Jurassic Park, right?
San Diego. Yeah, a T-Rex from a different island.
Oh, I don't remember.
Because the Lost World was a different island. Lost World is is the island.
That's right.
It was Isla Nublar. Isla Serna. Isla Serna and Isla Nublar.
Mm-hmm.
I only saw Lost World one time.
It's good, dude. There's some classic. I mean, you could tell. Yeah. I mean, Spielberg admits that he kind of like lost the wind in his sails about halfway through production. But there are moments in that movie that are classic, classic Spielberg moments. For me, being the most pinnacle being when the RV is hanging off the cliff, Julianne Moore is falling. You think she's going to fall through. Bam, she hits the glass.
You know what? It's interesting about that. Well, that scene is iconic. And I haven't seen the movie since I was a kid, and I still remember that scene. But the concept of dinosaurs running through our natural world is a freaky concept. I mean, it's a great idea. It just needs to be executed properly. Listen, I know you guys didn't love Fallen Kingdom, but my interest in Fallen Kingdom was the return to practical effects and bringing Jay Bayona, bringing back that Spielberg aspect of getting as much as they could in camera. With Colin Trevorrow coming back and the first one only having one animatronic dinosaur, I'm hoping he takes a page out of Bayona's book and also Spielberg's book and brings back that animatronic element. If he does that, think about Colin's position right now. He actually has a great chance to turn this around. He has a great chance to deliver a great Jurassic World film. And I think, you know, when he left Star Wars, Skywalker was ripped apart by a lot of fans. I wonder if he's going into this going, you know what? Okay, I understand people didn't love one. I made a lot of money. I got removed from Star Wars or whatever the story is there. This is kind of his chance to go here. Let me be a great filmmaker again. And I think that this is a big opportunity for someone like him who hasn't had a great track record recently to come back out and go, boom, here you go. And I think the way you do that is you bring back animatronics. You're already bringing back Goldblum. You're already bringing back Dern. I mean, there's a way to make this film almost the sequel to Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, if you can do it right.
I would love to see it. So today is day one of filming, and we'll continue to track Jurassic World Dominion as it goes through. So let's skip to this weekend movies. Now, I want to get to the first title that's written here, because I've not heard of it. It's called Greed. It's in limited release. Greed.
I think it's a sequel to Creed, but they go up in the letters.
Gotcha.
So it just goes up, and I think we did Deed.
Oh, I missed
Deed,
Dreed.
Feed. Yeah, you missed Feed. Did you see Feed?
No, I didn't see Feed.
Feed was amazing.
All right, we're going to
see Greed. Did you see Michael Douglas's review of that movie?
No.
Greed is good?
Greed is good.
I don't know why they don't put that on a poster. They should have paid Michael Douglas
Greed
to put that on a poster.
Good, Michael Douglas. But I will get to our second title that's here because I want to duke it out with Jake Hamilton. Wendy is going into limited release. And I loved this movie. We had Ben Zeitlin on the show last week. Hopefully getting you guys prepped for it. It is a Peter Pan narrative. Kevin, you haven't seen it, right?
I have not seen this movie yet.
Okay. Jake went to go see it in Chicago. He and I texted afterwards. And because he has no heart and hates beautiful things, he told me that it was terrible.
I didn't say it was terrible.
No, of course. I'm going the complete opposite into internet reaction. So I'm going to go first and just let you guys know that, again, you know, we're just sort of, do you recommend this or not recommend this? I absolutely recommend it, specifically if you enjoyed that kind of ethereal hyper surrealism that Ben Zeitlin brought to Beasts of the Southern Wild. And that was a movie that got a Best Picture nomination. He got Best Director that year as a first timer. He has a very specific approach to his storytelling. It's very handheld. It's a ton of close-ups. It deals in fantasy land, and he plugs that into the Peter Pan narrative, but tells it through the focal point of Wendy, which is she's a little girl who lives in what looks like a Louisiana type backwoods town. She hops on a train and heads off to Neverland with a Peter who recruits her to come with her. And then he films around an island in the Caribbean, essentially. And you meet the Lost Boys and you pick up other traces of the Peter Pan narrative. And he makes some changes to it, some tweaks to it, but ultimately comes around to what becomes the origin story for Peter and Captain Hook. And I was just enamored with it. Jake, you not so much.
I think it's absolutely gorgeous. I think it's visually stunning. I really was in awe of the cinematography. Loved the score. Like, could see this end up being, like, really end up seeing this being one of my favorite scores of the year. I just, and this is going to sound more harsh than I intend it to. I'm just telling you.
Setup. That's a good setup.
I'm not sure this movie has any reason to exist.
Okay, sure.
I just don't feel like when it was done, I don't feel like it added anything. Like, what is it? Like a cool, hip, more grounded, more real, visceral version of Peter Pan? It's still Peter Pan, and we don't need another Peter Pan, Sean. Like, we've gotten enough. Like, I don't need to see every director's version of Peter Pan. And like, yes, you can be like, yeah, but in this one, this person is Hook and this person is Peter and this person's Wendy. It's still the same damn story, dude. And it's still like, at the end of the day, it's a different person sitting around the campfire telling the same story. You could, all of us could sit around the campfire, tell the story of Peter Pan, and we might be telling it in a different way and add our own personal flavor to it, but we're still telling the same story, and I'm just tired of it, man. And I'm just not sure that the visuals, the story itself did not match the visuals. I pictured him being way more interested in just how gorgeous it is, and it is, than really adding anything. I love Beast of the Southern Wild. I would have loved if he had taken that flair and given us something original with it.
The part that I thought he dialed into that was different than what I've seen in other versions of Peter Pan, and
you haven't seen Hook.
No, he treats the idea of maturing.
Wait, you haven't seen Hook?
No, I've never seen Hook. No,
I didn't. What?
I've not seen Spielberg's Hook. No, sorry, I haven't seen it. No, it's true. I know.
That I know. I'm saying I'm sorry for you. No, I'm not saying I'm sorry for interrupting you.
It's a gaping hole in my filmography. Yeah.
That was a lot harsher than I intended it to be. Sorry.
It's one of those movies that everyone tells me is bad, but right. I grew up with it, so I absolutely love it.
I loved it. I love Hook.
But I don't know. I'm not going to. I even told Spielberg that, because Spielberg doesn't like it, and I told Spielberg that I like it.
Oh, then why on earth would I watch it? Like, what kind of recommendation is that?
Jokingly, though, Hook is considered to be a lesser film. Yeah. It is definitely not hailed as a good movie. But yeah. I, like Jake, Hook was a big movie in my childhood, and I love it. So I will stand on that mountain and love that movie. I have no problem with that.
Regardless, I liked what Ben Zeitlin tried to do in terms of treating aging, the concept of aging as a disease, and how it infects certain people and they have to react to aging. I thought he brought some really whimsical ideas to Peter Pan. I'm with Jake in the sense that, do we need another Peter Pan narrative? Nah, not necessarily, but I enjoyed the way that he told it. I agree with you 100% on the score. His score for Beasts was also beautiful, and this one is it's a really triumphant kind of entertaining adventure score, and he did it himself. He did it with his collaborator who he worked on with Beasts also, so he's a musician as well too. I like Ben Zeitlin a lot, so I'd say go see Wendy, especially if you're looking for a different version of the Peter Pan narrative. And when you're done with it, come back and listen to our interview with Ben Zeitlin, which is on episode number 106. Did either of you guys see Emma, which expands this week?
I did not.
Interesting. And then, so that brings us to The Invisible Man, which is the only big sort of wide release going this week. Jake, you see it tonight also?
Correct. Yep.
All right. So Kevin, this one falls on you. Spoiler-free review.
Spoiler-free. I just want to say this. I think that this is a film that really is going to teach a lot of people about how to remind people a lot about how low budget filmmaking is something that people need to understand and look into more. Because you look at the Get Out, for example, which was made for a very small budget as well. These are films that are very layered in character and very layered in interesting visuals, but then don't need a ton of money to tell their story. The Invisible Man is a film that I feel like could have easily been a $30, $40, $50 million film, and it looks like a $50 million film. And I think what Lee did here is he took the idea of the Invisible Man story and he based it in a message about domestic abuse. So Elizabeth Moss's character, as you'll see in the beginning of the film, is trying to escape her scientist husband who's been very abusive towards her. And as you can see in the trailers, he dies, right? And somehow haunts her through being through an invisible man of some sort. That's all I will say.
I want to pause you really fast.
Yeah.
Because I would have never thought to approach the Invisible Man that way. You right? know, like as they're trying to revive these Universal monster movies and they're
right.
they're old characters that I think it's hard to make them feel contemporary until someone comes up with an idea like that. And the minute you hear it, yeah. you're like, oh, damn, of course, that's a great way to do it.
Right. And think about how horrifying that is. So you, the person that you has been abusing you that you've outrun has died and they are somehow haunting you through some type of Invisible Man idea. Mm-hmm. And while what I said earlier in the show, what makes the film so scary is that nothing in the film actually feels out of reality. Yes, mm-hmm. we're maybe 20 years away and trillions of dollars away from creating this technology of how this would work. And it's one of those things where like your brain, when something is in within reach, within a reach of an idea of something that could be possible, that makes it 10 times scarier. And Elizabeth Moss's performance in this film just blew my mind. She is so great in it. Is the film perfect? No. I think it could have been cut down maybe about 10 minutes or so. But other than that, it is just truly a remarkable cinematic achievement. And I think people are not ready for how scary it is. And it's not scary in the sense of like scares that you're used to. It's more about tension building and just the sheer eeriness of looking at an entire room trying to figure out where this thing could possibly be, right? And so you have these wild shots of Elizabeth Moss walking through a gigantic open house, and you, as an audience member, are studying every inch of the frame. You are just as much a part of the cinematic process as the film itself. Like, you are involved. You're looking. You're seeing if a footprint is down somewhere, or if a curtain has been moved, and I found myself, and this is going to sound crazy, there's a moment in the trailer where she's in an attic, and she's like searching around in the attic, and I won't give away what happens in that scene, but I was in my chair getting up and looking over the frame, wow. trying to find more of the frame because I was almost trying to protect the character from getting hurt, God. And I don't know why I felt the need to protect her. Because I'm an audience member, but the way Lee directs that scene is he like as she goes towards the doorway of the attic, as you've seen in the trailer before she pours the paint, and as you're going towards the door, the opening of the door, you are looking over that doorway, even though it doesn't even exist on the frame. It wasn't even shot. You know what I mean? So to me, that's when a filmmaker has gotten you, right? And you think about the sound design, the visual effects aesthetic of it. See, all you really need to do to build tension is have a great actor in a scene, write the scene well, sound design that scene like crazy, and shoot it well. Visual effects are a tool that a director should use like in a paint, right? And if you're looking in paint, Microsoft Paint, and you start doing stuff to an image, CGI should be like one of the little tools you use to fill some stuff in, not to create the entirety of the scene. And I think what Lee did here is the in-camera effects of it is it just makes it so much more believable and scary. Like nothing in this film is, as I'm thinking about it right now, is downright the scariest thing I've ever seen. It's because of the way it was done that makes it so scary. So I just found the film to be incredibly well done. Ben Wahlfisch's score is genius. And Lee does a great job of allowing the score to stop and allowing you to live in those moments without any music. And then he just bursts the score at you in very interesting times. And that score becomes a character. And the camera becomes a character. And this is the last thing I'll say about it before we move on. When you guys watch the movie tonight, I'm very interested to talk to you guys afterwards because the camera itself is a character in the movie. And I mean that because he's giving you certain POV throughout the film and not really telling you what that POV is, which creates much more intensity as you watch it. So just, I'm curious what you guys think. I went in with very middle expectations. I didn't know what to expect. But when that thing started and that music hit and the eeriness of the way it's shot, it's just utterly terrifying. And it's awesome. And Kevin, I want to recommend Upgrade. If anybody hasn't seen Upgrade, I rewatched that again the other day. This is the kind of filmmaker we need nowadays to push out films at minimal budgets that show you that. You know what this movie does is it shines a light on every person who works on a movie. Like, I have never really stopped to think about sound design that much. And now I am because it's such an important factor into that. And that, by the way, that's a little tease ahead to my underrated 80s pick, by the way. But yeah.
Ooh, nice. I haven't heard your interview with Lee yet. We're including it in this week's episode. By the time we reach this segment of the show, everyone else will have heard it yet, so they'll know the answer to this. Did you ask him about the backstory of the most important character he has ever played on screen, the cargo pilot from Aquaman?
Oh, no. Yeah. No, he did start singing Toto's Africa at some
Thank
point,
God.
Which
yes.
was a really great moment. No, but you know what's crazy about Lee, and in the interview you probably heard this, his story is so cool, man. Like, him and James create this Saw film, right? And then that movie comes out of nowhere. It becomes this gigantic beast. And then Lee is, you know, co-writing and working on all these movies with James for all these years. He directs Insidious 3, and then he comes out the gate with Upgrade, a $3 million film that had no business being as good as it did. Right. The other day, I'm sitting in my living room. My college friends come over, and one of them had seen Upgrade, and the other one hadn't. And I throw it on, and to me, I get so much joy watching a movie, watching somebody see it for the first time, not knowing how awesome the film's going to be. Upgrade's a film that kind of creeps up on you. Have you guys both seen Upgrade?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it is...
Tom Hardy?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Fake Tom Hardy. But Gabe hasn't seen it. That's why.
It's a better version of Venom than Venom actually is.
But you got to think about Upgrade was Upgrade's not a perfect movie. I mean, there's some bad dialogue at times. I mean, every movie has flaws, but I mean, you got to think about what he did with what he did. And it's really kind of crazy. It really is. So
I also want to just take a moment before we move off of the Invisible Man. One of the things that fascinates me the most, and I'm going to show it to you guys here as well too. When you talk about a studio just hedging their bets and putting the cart way before the horse, I'm showing them a picture of the cast that was assembled for the Dark Universe. Yeah. And I guess we have to celebrate that the studio at least recognized that what they tried to set up with a mummy was so bad that they didn't push forward, like force it, you know, like force more movies in the franchise. But you have a cast photo here teasing a franchise, a connected universe franchise that would have had Russell Crowe, Javier Bardem, Tom Cruise, Johnny Depp, and Sofia Boutella. Now, four mega stars and an actress on the rise, right? And then you talk about the catering budget for whatever these movies would have been. Lee Whannell went and made a far better movie, and so a happy ending.
That's kind of where I'm thinking about right now. Like, had the connected universe actually continued on, we would not have this movie. And right. I think a lot of people are going into Invisible Man the way I did. It was like, okay, I've already seen this story. I've seen the Invisible Man. I'm kind of over the Universal Monster movie because Mummy wasn't great. Mummy with Tom Cruise and, you know, all the other films, you know, aren't happening or whatever. So I was wondering why I would want to see this. And I'm telling you, I think it's just going to shock people how well it's done. And it's funny because I'm sitting here like hyping this film up to you guys. And I want to make something clear. Like, when you go into a film with middle expectations, you know, when you get surprised by something, it really hits you. You become super passionate about it. And like, and you know what I mean? So when you guys watch the movie tonight, try to minimize my hype and just, you know, enjoy it.
You spent like 30 minutes like hyping this movie up and then you're like, no, but don't listen to me.
No, I say that because I have been on the other end of this spectrum where I've seen a film or I've seen people see a film that they were blown away by that and then I go in and Parasite did that to me actually. Parasite
1917.
Parasite was so hyped up when I went and saw it. It didn't live up to what I expected it to be. And, you know, again, that we're all human beings. We go in with certain bias. We all have certain ideas of what certain movies are going to be like based on filmmakers or actors or whoever's involved in them. So I just want you guys to, you know, I almost wish we didn't have to talk about the movie so you guys could have just saw it at the level I saw it at. You know what I mean? So just try to enjoy it from that perspective if you can.
You know what's better is when the hype is through the roof and you watch it and you go,
and it delivers.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they were right.
This one, I am truly confident. I'm confident you guys will enjoy the movie and think it's scary for sure.
One of the benefits of doing the junkets, actually, is that you oftentimes, one, like, you end up being the person that makes the hype one way or the other. You get to see the movie really usually before that initial reaction comes up.
Mm. I've been trying to scale it back on that one particularly because I know I saw it a couple weeks ago and I haven't really talked about it except to you guys over text. And I tweeted about one thing about it minorly when I was rewatching Upgrade, but I'm you guys got to message me afterwards. I want to have a full-fledged discussion next week about how the movie was done. I have no idea.
Gabe wants me to point out that there is a small spoiler portion of the 1L interview that we cut. We clipped it out. So look for it on Real Blend socials. After the movie is released, we will put out those answers and you guys will be able to hear Kevin's extended conversation with Lee Winnell.
Can I give a shout out to Aldous Hodge, by the way, who's fantastic in the film, and I don't think gets enough credit as an actor.
Sure.
I think he is so good in this movie. And once you guys see it, next week I'll tell you about a scene that will blow your mind because I can't say it now without context, but that guy crushed it. He's so good in the movie.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Yes, Jakey.
Quick breaking news, it's more business side than what we normally talk about. Disney CEO Bob Iger is stepping down.
Whoa, really?
Yeah, to be replaced by Bob Chapek.
I don't know who that is.
Chapek. Anyway, just came through, and I like when breaking news happens in the middle of the
show. Wow, goodness. Is Bob Iger's tired of making billions upon billions of dollars year after year?
Apparently. Yeah, he said it was an optimal time to step down following the Disney acquisition from Fox.
Well, it sounds like he's just moving onward, you know?
Does it not feel that the book on that movie is closed already?
Yes.
Like, I haven't even seen it. My screening is like a week away, and I feel like we've already dismissed it. It's over and done. Wow.
I'm actually shocked by that news because Iger has been such a pivotal player in all of this.
Yeah, I know.
Do you think he really stepped down?
I mean, he just came off of a year where Disney made, what, 7 different movies that crossed $1 billion? Like, it's not like can be found wanting or anything.
Why do you step down from that?
I don't know. Well, why not go out on top, man?
That's a good point, because this year is not going to be as big as last year.
I heard he's going to legally change his name to Bob Biger.
Oh God, they're getting worse.
You say Bob like he says goodbye.
Bob Biger. I give you Michael Douglas Green is good, and I get like a half chortle. Like, thanks, Jake. Thanks for participating.
That's not
you
true.
Get
we
Bob Biger
just fine.
And the two of you are tickled pink like a couple of schoolgirls.
Yeah, but Sean, we don't know that Jake isn't telling a Bob Liger right now. I mean, he could be completely lying to us. You know, this could be just some thing he's pulling on us, you know?
Oh, maybe he's going to go over to another studio and be a Bob Spiker. All right,
Jake's gonna get really mad and Bob Diger in a second here if we don't stop saying these puns.
Do you know his favorite Sugar Ray song, Kevin?
No, please tell me.
Bob Flieger.
Flieger. Did you hear about his favorite movie starring Shannon Elizabeth?
Oh yes, American Piger.
American Piger. Yeah. There you go. That's a good one.
Clearly you know his favorite Rocky song, right?
No.
Oh. Eye of the Tiger. Eye of the Bob Tiger.
Iger of the Tiger.
I hate this show.
Jake,
I hate this
crying.
Show.
I'm Kreiger. I'm actually Bob Kreiger. All right, blend game. We're playing hashtag underrated 80s blend. A while back we did underrated 70s blend where we picked films that we thought don't get enough attention. So that's the challenge, is finding a movie that you think you can define as underrated. And I think it's going to get harder as we get into decades where, you know, so many of the films that we grew up with and love are worshipped and adored. And so, Kevin, tell us what you chose, since you teased what your choice is going to be. What was your pick for hashtag underrated 80s blend?
Well, it's funny. I want to give a shout out to a friend of mine I had in high school. His name was Chris Ingram. And Chris was somebody that I worked at a movie theater with. And he was an avenue into a lot of films that I began to love. He's the one who showed me True Romance. He's the one who we watched a lot of Robert Rodriguez films growing up. I used to go to his house all the time. We'd watch like a bunch of David Lynch movies like Lost Highway, Mulholland Drive. He was like a friend that like really kind of was a big gateway into different filmmakers for me. And one of the films I remember him telling me about when I was growing up that I had never heard of before, that I later found out was one of Quentin Tarantino's favorite movies ever, and now it makes perfect sense, was Blowout. Brian De Palma's Blowout. And It was a film that made no money. I mean, reportedly, I think about $13 million at the box office. Very underrated in regards to that. I think nowadays it is hailed as a classic. It's in a, you know, it's an iconic film. I was reading somewhere that, you know, obviously with Quentin Tarantino loving that movie, that was that could have possibly been a reason for his hiring on Pulp Fiction. But you know, this is an 81 film by De Palma, and it is such a great concept and a great story. This, you know, Travolta plays a guy who's working on a film. He's trying to collect sound effects for a low budget film he's making, and while collecting sound effects, he records the sound of a massive car crash into a creek, and rescues the girl, and then the driver dies. And that particular idea is so fascinating, because what can you get from sound that could help solve a case? And it really is, it's a film I've only seen, I think, twice. And the reason I used it today was because I was going through 80s films, and there's so many big 80s films that I just wouldn't consider to be underrated. And Blowout was the one that popped out to me, because I was like, no one really talks about Blowout that often. It's a great film. Tarantino considers it one of the greatest movies ever made. De Palma is one of the, you know, whatever you want to say about him, he's a phenomenal filmmaker.
One of Travolta's best performances.
100%. I mean, it is, next to Pulp Fiction, it might be my second favorite performance from him. I just think it's, no, I'm sorry, Face Off would be second, then Blowout third. But there is something special about this film in regards to, you know, if you, sound design is something I was talking about earlier in the show with Upgrade and The Invisible Man. It's a film that really kind of gives you an idea of how important sound is, really. And the reality, the reason why I chose it, because it's been years since I've seen it, is because I just kind of wanted to highlight it on the show. I wanted to bring attention back to it, because the film was brought to my attention when I was in high school by my friend Chris. I've told people about watching it over the years. And, you know, one of the best things about doing this show every week is when people write us emails or messages and say, hey, I watched so-and-so film because the show mentioned it. And
I love that.
It's been so long since I've seen Blowout that now I want to go back and rewatch it based on the conversation I'm having right now with you guys. Just saying it out loud and talking about it again.
That's awesome.
We all have special people in our lives who delivered us or showed us films. And I think it's funny because we measure a lot of our lives about when movies come out. Oh, I remember that. Yeah, it came out around the same. Like, I remember my brother's wedding because it came out around the time I did Mad Max. You know what I mean? Movies are so connected to our daily lives that there is someone that's, it means something to you connected to the film. So Chris showing me this film in high school gave me an appreciation for De Palma, gave me an appreciation for where Quentin Tarantino may have gotten Travolta. So Blowout, definitely see it. Highly recommend it.
That's awesome, man. Great choice. I want to just read really quick where Travolta was at that time in his career. In 76, he did Carrie. Same year, he did a TV movie that was extremely popular called The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. Then in 77, he did Saturday Night Fever. In 78, he did Grease. He was doing Welcome Back, Kotter during those years, 75 to 79. Then in 80, he did Urban Cowboy, and in 81, he did Blowout, and 83, he did Staying Alive. Like, that dude was...
He turned down American Gigolo to do Blowout.
Yeah, that dude was on fire at the time. My God.
Until the 80s.
Yes, yes. Jakey, underrated 80s pick for you, sir.
My pick for underrated 80s is Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Dream Warriors great.
Which I think you could make... I mean, here's the deal. My heart is always going to be with the original Nightmare. There's just, I mean, it's hard to say that that's not the best one. But Freddy Krueger, as you know him within the realm of pop culture, was not born from the original Nightmare on Elm Street. He was born from Nightmare on Elm Street 3. That's where he becomes the Freddy Krueger that you know and love. But it also is sort of this great... kind of what I'd imagine something like New Mutants is going to be, because this is almost this like X-Men of kids who are kind of trapped in this psychiatric institute because they're all having these issues with Freddy in their dreams, and all their parents think that they're crazy. So they send them to this psychiatric institute, and each of them have their own personal inner flaw, which ends up being the power that they use to take on Freddy. And it's also from a script written by two guys who know how to tell a story, Wes Craven and Frank Darabont.
Nice.
So and that's
Darabont wrote that. Wow.
Darabont and Wes Craven wrote it.
No idea.
And you see the return of Nancy, and it's great to see. It's a great return on that character. A fun cameo from Johnny Depp. He returns briefly in it. A lot of really striking visuals. There's one scene in particular that now people argue it has not quite aged well, but it's really where the Nightmare series began to take shape in terms of what people know it is today. Because if you know Freddy from how big of a character he is in pop culture, and then you see the original Nightmare, you go, well, that doesn't really seem like the guy that I've seen and everything else. That was all born in Dream Warriors, which is truly, truly incredible. It came out in 87. Easily the best sequel and as good of a Freddy Krueger movie as you're going to get short of the original. I think if you take the nostalgia and your heart out of it, you could make a very solid argument that it's actually the best Nightmare film. But I think my heart is just too close to the original film to call it not the best one.
So. Jake, do you still think that as much as you love 3, do you still think 1 has the best death? I think Depp's death
when Depp's sucked into the
that is one of the most terrifying. Like,
I think the girlfriend in the first act where they had to build he inceptioned before it was inception where he had to build the room that turned and the girl is being murdered as she's going up on the roof that they end up blaming the boyfriend for. I think that's brutal because imagine you're the boyfriend in that scenario.
Okay,
no,
but wait.
You know what scared me the most about those movies though is like when somebody would get killed like that and there was no explanation that the person could say to prove their innocence because there's nothing you could do because how do you prove that that this guy did this in her sleep? And I think to me those are some of the most terrifying things in a horror film is when you put a blame on a character that has no way of proving themselves that they did nothing wrong. That's so freaking scary to me. That's almost scarier than the death itself, I think.
There's a death in Dream Warriors, if I can remember it correctly, that still disturbs me to this day, where Freddy does somebody like a puppet, like a marionette.
Yeah.
And her arms and her legs are sticking out and her veins come out of her arms and her feet. Yeah. And those become the strings that Freddy walks her along like a puppet. Yeah. And it's a very realistic effect.
Yeah. Because at the time, I mean, it's the 80s, so it's still practical effects. The death that always disturbed me, and it's really, it's a disturbing image, is that there is a character who is a heroin addict in the film. Mm. And his fingers, where there used to be knives, become syringes.
Oh.
And she has the sores that turn into these gaping mouths that are essentially begging for the drug. It's really a disturbing film.
And injects all the heroin needles into her.
If you haven't seen Dream Warriors, Dream Warriors is a great, great horror film.
Speaking of syringes, Lee Winnell did offer his apologies for the syringe scene in Saw 2 when they have to dive into a pit of hypodermic needles, which is one of the most horrifying death scenes I've ever seen in my life.
It's really funny.
You imagine having to dive into a hypodermic needle pool to find a key? You're just like digging through it? Oh my God. Yeah, come on, man.
You guys went with serious picks. Mine is a little bit goofy, but goofy in the best way possible. I went with Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon.
Great movie.
Now, underrated? Do you guys think it counts as underrated?
Yeah, I'd call it underrated.
It's underrated for the 80s because the 80s has so many big movies that falls under the radar for sure.
So I took it down off the shelf and I revisited it because, A, I love it. I love everything about it. And what it struck me, I hadn't even realized, it's very much what Dolomite is now. It's a ton of things that the director just loved and he stuck them all together. There's an El DeBarge music video in the middle of it because the girl is a DJ at the club. There's Kung Fu all through it. Like when Rudy Ray Moore is like, I like Kung Fu. I'm going to put Kung Fu in this movie.
Chop me a mother...
It's R&B, you know, just thrown in. It's like sassy kids from New York City neighborhood who love going to kung fu movies. And it's one of the most memorable villains you'll ever see in Shonuff, the Shogun of Harlem. And it's about this guy named Leroy, who they call Bruce Leroy. It's mildly racist. Like, it makes these little jokes throughout it. Like, Leroy's father is a black man who owns a pizza store in New York, and he gets a lot of flack because they say no one ever is ever going to eat at a black man's pizza place. They call Leroy Bruce Leroy, which cracks me up. And they're all trying to get the glow, which is a really bad 80s effect where it's like a Star Wars type thing where Leroy's is yellow and it encases his body. And when the Shogun of Harlem gets it, he turns red like a Sith, and they can kind of like shoot stuff from their fingertips. And when they battle, it looks like a Star Wars battle. It's all of these genres just mashed together in this wildly entertaining film that I watched on Saturday mornings and afternoons, I think like every weekend that it was on, because it was just the greatest and most entertaining thing. And there's a little boy in it who ended up being in a TV show called Sidekicks. His name is Ernie Reyes, and he was like a 9-year-old karate wizard. And I loved the scene in Last Dragon where at the end all of the gangsters show up at the club and all the karate kids finally decide, all the Leroy's students decide, hey, we're gonna fight back. And they're students, but they finally realize that they're good at karate. And then like this kid Ernie Reyes comes through and like kicks all these adults' asses. And it was like one of the most fun scenes because it was like a 9 or 10 year old kid just whipping out karate skills. And at that age, I was like, oh, I want to be that kid so bad. So everything about it is amazing. I think people have sort of found it through the years because of its cult classic status to it. But if you haven't ever seen Berry Gordy's The Last Dragon, it is a great mashup of 80s style, 80s music, 70s kung fu type skills, and just a lot more attitude and humor than it deserves to have. So I'm sending people in that direction.
Love I want to see that. I want to rewatch that now based on what you just said. So thank you for recommending that. Yeah,
so much fun. The Shogun of Harlem is great. His name is Shonuff. And when he shows up into a scene, he goes, am I the baddest? And all the people around him have to go, Shonuff. Am I the prettiest? Shonuff. It's great. It's really fantastic. Let's see. Next week, what are we playing? I'm sorry. Audience picks. Jordan Snyder played along. He chose Death Trap, which I've actually never seen. And I know he said something on Twitter about it being he's in a Knives Out mode. So is Death Trap like a murder mystery type thing? I don't know. Marcus Brown chose Once Bitten, the Jim Carrey film.
Oh, fun.
Oh, Jelani Williams also chose Last Dragon. Look at that. Not alone. And Kelly Ray chose Outrageous Fortune, which I think is Shelley Duvall and Bette Midler, if I remember correctly. It's Bette Midler for sure, but I'm not sure. She made a movie with Danny DeVito. That was down and out in Beverly Hills. I'm blanking. Anyway, thank you very much for everybody's participation this week for playing along. Oh, God, Gabe. Well done, sir.
Well done. Is this our new blend game?
What is it?
For next week, you're going to reach out on Twitter.
Wait, I know what it is.
Yeah,
it's hashtag Bob Iger blend, isn't it?
You're gonna reach out.
Rise of Skywalker.
Playing hashtag Ben Affleck blend.
Oh.
And you're gonna let us know your pick via social media.
Performance, right? Not directing, right?
Well, I don't know.
Well, if I mean,
you
want to
make the parameters right now?
No parameter. I thought that was the whole thing of this game is that there's no parameters.
But hold on a second. If he directed a film. Are you
the only one he directed that he's not in is Gone Baby Gone.
Okay, so does Gone Baby Gone count as a Ben Affleck movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
Yeah, cool. For sure. All right. You're just using Ben Affleck blend somehow. If you want to email us because you don't use social media, you can email us at realblend@cinemablend.com. But for most people, go to the Twitter feed and play along with us or Instagram. Gabe, we need an Instagram. No? We don't? How about a TikTok? Can we do a TikTok? He's thinking about it. All right, reviews. This one comes from Kay.
Just a TikTok of nothing but Kevin doing puns.
Come on. That Bob Iger blend was a sweet little detour for this week's episode.
That was a good pun.
This is Kay Laud from Australia this week, who writes in the subject line, love it! !! I just started listening as of last week after listening to the Quentin Tarantino one. I'm a massive fan of his, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood literally made me fall back in love with movies. The whole podcast explaining the setup before meeting him, the effort you guys did, how you didn't hold back, what giant fans you were, hooked me from start to finish. The part where you said he shouted, I expect him to give me 10s and he gives me 15s really made me smile. Such an awesome moment. Fantastic movie podcast, guys. Goes in depth, but isn't pretentious, and the banter between all of you is great. Nice work from K-Law in Australia. So thank you so much for putting that review together. I still can't believe everything we went through. Like that day in New York City to pull off.
She's talking about the LA day.
I guess she's talking about the LA day because that's when he said that quote to us. Oh, K-Law, find the 2-hour Tarantino follow-up because that is, that's a real doozy. And the story about how we pulled that one off is even better than the Tarantino interview, I would say. Outro, where can listeners follow us? You can find Jake at Jake's Takes. Pictures of his dog abound. Kevin is at Kevin McCarthy TV, and I'm at Sean_O'Connell. Obviously, please drop us a review. We'll try to read it on the show. We'll be back next week playing hashtag Ben Affleck Blend and reviewing The Way Back. Is that right?
Yeah, The Way Back and Onward both open next week.
And we have an interview with the director of The Way Back, Gavin O'Connor, which I can tease because we did it. It's in the can. So
yeah, and he's amazing, by the way. And for people out there who are listening to our show, before you listen to that interview, if you haven't seen Warrior, see it because it's incredible.
It's obviously, it's one of the best films I've seen in the past decade.
It's
like,
so
I go
good.
Back and revisit it often, and it's just amazing. Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton.
Nick Nolte. I didn't know Nolte was based on based off of Gavin's father. Like, there's a lot of things that we learned in the interview with Gavin, which you'll hear next week. But there's a lot of really cool stuff in there. And the answer he gives about Miracle. Wait till he takes you down Miracle Lane. It's awesome. So
I'm gonna have to admit that I tried to show Warrior to Michelle, and she can't watch it.
Why?
Because she can't listen to Nick Nolte.
The voice?
The voice. There's something about it. It's like a fork on a plate, you know, or one of those type things. And it is really gravelly in that movie. It's super, like, Nick Nolte size. But we're, like, a half an hour into it, and she's like, I got to tap out. I can't do it. So I'm going to force her to watch Warrior this week to get in preparation for our Gavin O'Connor interview. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening to episode number 107 of Real Blend. We'll be back next week. And until then,
Dunkirk.
Hey, Drew Scott here.
And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.